Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Goldberg v. 401 North Wabash. Mr. Colwin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Shelley Colwin. I represent Plaintiff Appellant Jacqueline Goldberg, who is present in court sitting in front row. Your Honors, there are multiple issues that we believe justify reversal here. I propose to address first those related to the securities claim, the unfair practice claim, and the unfair trial. The district first.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the breach of contract. That seemed to me the central claim. So I don't understand. As I read the contract, the purchase agreement, it's very clear, and it says that the Trump Organization can alter the terms in the declaration, which include compensation for these common elements. And if the purchaser doesn't like that, she doesn't get the condominium, she gives up the condominium, she doesn't have to pay the rest of the price, but she doesn't get her down payment back. And if that's a correct understanding of the contract, I don't see how there could be a breach here.
Well, Your Honor, there would be a breach because it breaches the implied covenant of good faith in the way it was done. Although a breach,
I don't understand that.
We're not appealing.
If a contract states on its face, this is a contract with a very sophisticated person,
yes,
wealthy, highly educated, financially experienced, access to lawyers and accountants. If the contract is perfectly clear, what can the breach mean? Now, I understand if you also have your fraud theory, which the jury rejected. Is that what you mean, that a breach of implied warranty of good faith, that would be another way of articulating your fraud theory? Is that what?
Well, just to clarify, Judge, we're not appealing the judgment against us on the breach of contract claim, although we are saying we should have had a jury. Putting that aside, what I'm saying is that you can have a contract defense, a discretionary clause such as this change clause, which I don't think is as crystal clear as the defendants make it out to be. It does say that it requires her approval.
Well, there are actually two clauses, and I think Judge Posner was referring to that. There's a property report that says the declaration is and at all times shall remain subject to change by the developer, and the material terms of the declaration are likewise subject to change. And then you also have, I think what you're just now referring to, Section 4A of the purchase agreement, that's a little more muddled. I mean, it says there's the right to modify the condominium documents, provided that there's notification, if notification is required. I'm summarizing a bit. But taken together, that's pretty strong language to support discretion up to the time of closing to change. And so I'm interested in the same question as Judge Posner, and I'm also interested in whether there's any case that you know of in Illinois that says that parties are not entitled to modify these approval requirements, requirements of 75% buyer approval. You know, sophisticated commercial parties often modify background rules of law.
Well, I think your question, the direct answer is there is a case. In the Kirkpatrick case, for example, the condominium developer had the right to change the, I believe, ceiling height by 8 inches, and the Illinois appellate court said that's sufficient to support an unfair practice claim. Putting that aside.
But did both parties agree to the change?
In Kirkpatrick?
Well, did both parties agree to the
clause?
Ability to change.
Yes. In that case, yes. And as the district court pointed out, the district court found that we could prevail on the unfair practice claim despite this clause. That's not why she struck the claim.
Wait, before you get to the unfair labor practice, I'm very surprised what you say about that the breach of contract issue isn't before us. There's a lot of discussion in the briefs, for example, of whether rescission is equitable or legal.
Well, Judge, the breach of contract claim, whether we were entitled to a jury trial or not, is before you. Okay? What happened was the judge...
Well, I don't understand. If you've given up on the breach of contract claim, then it doesn't matter whether judge or jury. So it must be, if you're still concerned about whether it's equitable or legal, that you would like to have another crack at the breach of contract claim.
We believe it should have been tried in front of a jury, but putting that...
So you haven't given it up, have you? You want
no.
us to reverse and say you're entitled to a jury trial on a breach of contract.
That's true, but I
don't... Well, I don't understand where on earth you get the idea that rescission is not an equitable remedy.
Rescission is an equitable remedy, Judge, but the court held previously, and I believe the case was the Walmart case, really whether or not you're entitled to a jury trial or not depends on the maximum of who's in possession of the money.
On what? I can't...
Who's in possession of the money.
No, it doesn't. That doesn't make any sense at all. The money could be in a Donald Trump's wallet, right? Or it could be hanging from a tree branch in Central Park. The point is, if you get rescission and you restore the status quo ante to some extent, then one person has to give back money and the other person has to give up the contractual right, right? I don't know why, whether it's an escrow or this or that, I don't know why that should make any difference, whether there's a jury trial or not. I don't get it.
I can only say, Judge, that from looking at the Great Western Life case and the Walmart case, what the court held in Walmart, for example, was that basically it was an equitable remedy because they were essentially seeking a constructive trust.
You're not speaking clearly.
I'm sorry.
In Walmart,
the court held that the reason it was equitable was because they were seeking a constructive trust. They were going after the lawyer who held the money.
No, it's equitable if you're seeking rescission, which means that you have a contract and you want to dissolve the contract and put the parties back in some approximation to their position before the contract was signed. And that often involves one party. If it's a contract of sale and there's been payment by the buyer, then the rescission results in return of money to the buyer.
I understand your position, Your Honor. The cases, as I read them, seem to indicate to me that it really boiled down to, at least that's what they said.
But why? Is there a reason for that?
Yes, Judge, because the reason was that if the money was not in the possession of the defendant, what you were really suing for, regardless of the nomenclature, was for damages. A contract claim.
No, why is that? It does not become damages. It's getting your money back. It's part of an unwinding of a deal.
I can only tell you what...
Okay, so in other words, there is no reason for this. All right.
I would like you to go back to the topic that you alluded to when you started on the Securities Act, because I'm having trouble seeing exactly what you think is a security. I have great reservations about whether the ownership of the hotel condominium units themselves fits in any way into the investment contract box. And if what you're saying is that the potential ownership of the common elements is what makes it a security, I'm having trouble seeing how that distinguishes this case from any other case where a condo association might have a health club that's part of the building or might have, a party room that people can book and enjoy parties in. You've argued, that you don't think there should be a horizontal commonality test. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more what exactly you think is the investment contract here.
Well, the investment contract, Judge, is that Mrs. Goldberg purchased solely for investment purposes, not for consumption like in United Housing.
So all
yes,
hotel
I know. That can't be right. People might buy a house. Remember in the housing bubble, people were buying houses, flipping them, and so on. It was investment.
People do own a lot of real estate for investment purposes, but that doesn't mean that, you know, if I go out and buy a house in Austin, Texas, that it's an investment contract.
You're absolutely right, Judge. But in all the cases that are cited in the briefs, for example, as opposed to here, for example, in this case, she was buying two hotel rooms, which included a pro rata share of pooled rental opportunities and, if I may, and hotel facilities. These were not incidental facilities being provided by the tenants like your health club or your parking garage where there was no expectation of profits. These were commercial facilities specifically placed, as the testimony said, into the promotional material and the offering memorandum, the property report, okay, generating a $5 million stream of income.
Well, that part wasn't there. I mean, what the possibility on the other side is that she buys the hotel condominium units, yes, for an investment. She expects that she's going to get them in the pool of things that are rented out through the management company. And then there are these elements that wind up being called the commercial elements that might be used to reduce the monthly assessment that a condo owner has to
more
pay.
Than that, Judge.
Well,
more.
Far more. What would have happened if there had been profit under the original arrangement that got changed?
Well,
would this have been dividends paid, in your view, to the owners?
Two points on that, Judge. The Trump defendants were projecting in the first year $1.4 million in profits off those facilities.
But they're telling us in the briefs that you're using gross numbers, not net numbers.
That's inaccurate, Judge. And if you took the time.
Well, let's be specific. What does the record show about the amount of money that she could reasonably expect to receive every year from all these incidentals?
In the first year, her percentage would be.
I'm not interested in percentage. I want a dollar number.
The condominium association was projected to receive in the first year $1.3 million.
Look, my question is, what could she have expected? She's not going to get $1.2 million.
She would get.
What is she going to get?
Approximately 2% of that number.
I don't want the 2%. I want the number, and I want to know whether it's in the record.
Several hundred dollars. It is in the record.
Pardon?
Several hundred dollars, and it is in the record.
Several hundred dollars in the entire year?
I believe over the course of the year it would be $1,400 to $1,700. I don't have the
How
specific
many?
Number. Something like $1,400 to $1,700.
$1,400 to $1,700, and her monthly assessment was practically $5,000.
Right, and that would be an increase. That would be an increase.
So it would have just taken it off. That's not supposed to happen.
But look what you're doing. You're taking the concept of a security, and you're turning a condominium sale into a security contract because of these trivial extras.
These were not
$1,400 a year relative to a $2 million investment,
Judge,
is very trivial.
The Trump defendants, and it was conceded at trial, placed these facilities into the materials.
I'm talking about the money, and I am wondering whether the implication of your securities theory is that the scope of securities law just explodes. Every condominium sale becomes and every contract with the individual seller is a separate security.
It would not.
And by the way, would these have to be registered with the SEC?
They'd have to be registered in Illinois.
Would it have to be registered in the SEC?
If they all
these are interstate contracts.
Perhaps so. Yes.
Perhaps so. Well, what?
Judge,
I mean, this is ridiculous. How many
is.
Condominium sales do we have in the United States every year?
None that have strictly sales of hotel condominiums where
I wouldn't say none if I were you.
Very few that simultaneously have. What you're doing is you buy a room in a hotel.
No, look,
all of the
your theory is that if she just has access to the swimming pool, that makes it an investment contract.
No, it's not my theory. My theory is that when a promoter puts something into the promotional materials specifically to attract people who otherwise are
well,
not...
Well, the swimming pool is an attraction, okay?
No, No,
it's not an attraction.
For Mrs. Goldberg, 90 years old, no, it's not an attraction.
Well, let me ask this question. I'm going to be nice to you and suggest that your argument is a little bit narrower, but still troublesome. Some amenities in condos are there largely for the use of the residents, whether it's a swimming pool or a health club or whatever else. You seem to be saying that the particular commercial entities, these ballrooms and meeting rooms in Trump Tower, were income-generating facilities. They're commercial facilities. And so if you're arguing that when one of the things that goes along with condo ownership is, in a sense, a separate business, you know, you're out renting ballrooms to conventions that come into town, where the income is going to vary. Maybe it's going to be a good year for conventions in Chicago and there'll be a lot of income. Maybe it's going to be a bad year and everybody goes to Las Vegas and it'll be a bad year. But I can think of plenty of condominium buildings just off the top of my head that actually have income-generating places, too. They have little convenience stores that sell products to people who don't want to run out in the middle of the night. So I'm not even sure that that is enough to say it's all of a sudden become an investment.
The standard is it something incidental for use only by the tenants? What happened here is that they put in these things, projecting $5 million in revenue that they anticipated would make $1.3 million in the first year, a couple of million more thereafter, PX13. And moreover, if it wasn't worth anything, if there was no serious profit, then why then did Mr. Trump, when he took it away unilaterally for his own financial benefit, say, I gave them $500,000 a year in perpetuity.
No one's saying it's worthless. That's not the point.
But
I know I understand he puts in the $500,000,
and calls it obligated equity.
Right. You could say, I'm trying to keep as close as can be to what you expected your monthly assessment was going to be, because that's really where this money was going to go. I'm going to go back to the Howey test and say, there's investment of money. Where's the common enterprise?
The common enterprise is twofold. Well, first of all, if we look at it vertically, which is what the court should have found, because under Illinois law, 20 years of consistent precedent, never yet contradicted, Illinois Supreme Court rejected the opportunity in 2002 to change it, where they specifically addressed, are we adopting vertical or are we adopting horizontal? We're adopting vertical. And then Judge Posner's opinion in Wall says, what's vertical? Co-venturers operating with an expectation of profit, even in a timeshare situation.
Yeah, but we rejected vertical commonality.
That's right. You did reject it. But here we're sitting in diversity. And the question is, what would Illinois courts do?
The Illinois Supreme Court has actually never spoken on this.
They declined the PLA in integration.
I'm more concerned, not with different horizontal and vertical, but the extraordinary implications of your position for the scope of security law, both federal and state.
I see.
Because condominia often involve shared facilities.
Right.
I don't see analytically how you can make a distinction between monetary returns on an investment and amenity returns.
I think that there's several factors. I'm running out of time. There is another issue I'd like to get to, but to briefly answer that question, there was the Trump defendant specifically said that, as Mr. Reese said, that the reason this was put in there was because they wanted to attract people who were looking at it as an investment deal who would use this income to offset expenses and thereby increase their profit margin. And they were all on their rentals, which, by the way, were controlled by a pro rata pool, which, by the way, depended solely on the efforts of Trump. Depreciation.
It would be no
different
if someone sold a house and say, "Oh, by the way, I'll throw in my membership in the country club,
make it
more attractive."
Mr. Cohen,
you're
running out of time, and I think we've spent a fair number of time
Good.
On securities.
Thank you.
Very interested in the unfairness issue.
Okay. Unfair practice claim, Judge?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Because I think that's...
let me get to
there's
that.
There's a leg to stand on.
Right.
That seems to be the one you ought to focus on.
It is, Judge. What happened with the unfair practice trial? On the eve of trial, Judge St. Eve said, we submitted an instruction for the unfair practice. And she said, I'm not putting that to the jury. Now, this is after the claim had passed a motion to dismiss and summary judgment. She based it solely on it would be prejudicial surprise to the defendants.
Well,
the defendants
did not. What is she saying, really? I mean, she understands that these are separate claims, but I understood her to be saying that as the case had evolved, and the judge is supposed to look at that, you know, what evidence really comes forward, nothing separate from the deceptive practices claim had been brought forward.
But she had already ruled that we had alleged sufficiently 12B.
But that's allegation. You know, the case becomes richer as time goes on.
Right, and it was very rich 3 years later at summary judgment time when we specifically relied on the unfair practice, saying even if we can't prove deceptive practices, and we had an expert who testified to a variety of factors that would support it.
What does unfairness mean in this context?
In this context, it means the arbitrary exercise of discretion by taking away all
these... But I don't understand. If it's all written into the contract, and the contract says, yeah, we can take all this away, and if you've signed the purchase agreement, you know, you're not bound to take the property or pay the balance, but you don't get your down payment.
Contract clause.
Dealing with a sophisticated person, what's unfair?
The sophistication's irrelevant. We do not have
reliance. No, it's not irrelevant.
We do not have a reliance.
You talk about things like bait and switch. Bait and switch is, you know, that's targeted at consumers. This is not a consumer. So I don't see what the contract claim.
She is a consumer.
She goes over this stuff with all her lawyers, and she spends a year before she decides. What's the?
She is a consumer, Judge, and regardless of whether she spent a year or 6 months,
she's not a little person who is protected by the unfair. It acts and practices, you know.
Nor was the diamond purchaser in Thompson.
Well, I mean, there's a statutory definition. Judge, do you have any other questions?
Well, I guess you want to know why you spent a fair amount of time on the breach and the deceptive practices. Isn't unfairness an easier route?
That was what my plan was coming up. The unfairness is an easier route, Judge, but she barred it right before trial, and we didn't during the discovery. We submitted an expert report that laid out in detail all the factors that we thought supported unfairness. And regardless, by the way, regardless of whether the court thinks maybe it's not unfair, maybe it is unfair, the district court thought it was unfair. There are a number of factors that the jury could have considered.
What's the most unfair factor?
The most unfair factor was to put something in there specifically to lure her in who we had no interest in.
No. The luring in, that's your fraud claim.
That's unfair practice. No, it's an
unfair...
Well,
wait a second. You can't.
If
your unfair claim is your fraud claim, fraud claim went to the jury. Jury rejected it. So the unfair, insofar as it is identical to fraud, falls with it.
Even if they didn't intentionally do it, taking it away and then tell it for their own financial.
But you tell a person, we can take this away. Be warned.
They didn't tell her that.
Ask your lawyer. Right?
They didn't tell her that.
Oh, come on. They didn't have to.
They didn't
She's
tell her
She's a wealthy
that.
Person with lawyers and accountants.
Right,
at
and
her
lawyer.
Beck and call.
And her lawyer said, I want the clause removed. And if you look at the contract, she said, I want the clause removed because I want her to have approval. And if you look at the contract, that's what it says. It says she has the right to approval. And be that all as it may, to take it away. And then say, take it or leave it. I'm going to sell you something completely different
than the contract.
You can
take it away.
You can have an unfair practice.
You don't get your down payment back.
You can have an unfair practice claim while having a contract. There's one other issue I'd like to get to, if I may.
Why don't you do that? And if need be, I'll give you an extra minute or two.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's another aspect of it that I want to get to, which is the fraud claims themselves, the unfairness of that trial. There is no question during the course of this trial that the defendants argued very specifically, in closing argument, very specifically, they said, you can't have a fraud claim, you can't have a case about change when there's a change clause in the context of a fraud case.
So the district court seemed to recognize, though, that that wasn't right. She instructs a couple of times that even if there's a change clause,
she never does.
It's still possible.
She rules. She rules that way. She tells the lawyers that, but she never tells the jury that. At the end of the trial, I was standing in front of a jury at closing argument trying to convince them that I had a right to be there, that the court didn't err in not granting summary judgment, because what the defense had argued, and especially Mr. Trump on the stand, but counsel, in opening statement, he said, she knows she has no case because of the change clause, which was erroneous, factually misrepresented. And in closing argument, he repeatedly said, you can't have a case about change when there's a change clause. And
actually,
the jury...
I agree with that.
Do you agree with that?
Fraud is deception. If you tell a person that, you know, I'm going to...
Well, what you're saying, Judge, is she should have granted summary judgment.
Right,
she hadn't.
Well, I don't understand. If the change clause is clear, where's the deception? We're telling you, we can take these amenities away, and all you'll do will be able to, you know,
here's the deception.
Get your money back, right?
Here's the deception, Judge. If you come to me and say, I'll sell you a blue car, but I can change it to red, and I tell you I really want a blue car, you say, well, we got 1,000 of them, don't worry. But remember, I can change it to red. And you take my $50,000 for the red car, knowing no blue cars.
Who said don't worry?
If they knew going in.
I want the analogy to the don't worry. Okay. When did they say don't worry?
When they say in the promotional materials.
No, that's the. Look,
when they say that you can have.
But
hotel,
you have a purchase agreement which makes.
Because it's contrary. Here's where they say it. It's contrary to the entire industry. Both experts testified. It's never done. And it violates the Condo Act.
As your lawyer, can this guy, or you know, the Trump organization, can they back out and eliminate all these amenities? And the lawyer will tell her, yeah, it says so, right?
The lawyer will tell her subject to your approval. That's what the contract says. That's what the Illinois Condo Act says.
You're talking about the modification provision.
No, I'm talking about the change clause. If you look at the change clause, it says it requires her approval as required by the Act. And she could interpret that. And by the way, we don't know what the lawyers would have said because they didn't testify. This came in as an exhibit over objection. They did not testify. So the question is this. If they know, if Mr. Trump knew, as we believe the evidence clearly supported, if he knew going in, I am never going to give them these hotel facilities, I am never going to give them this stream of income, but I know, which is also undisputed at trial, that this is going to cause people exactly like Jacqueline Goldberg to buy these units. I'll put it in, they'll buy it, and then I'll take it away on the back end when it suits my needs. That's fraud, that's deception, and that's true whether there's a change clause or not, and that's what the court ruled. What you're saying, judges, if there's a change clause, there can't be a statutory fraud claim. That's wrong, with all respect. And so what happened here is we've got a jury sitting there going, change clause, change clause, change clause bars the case. What are they doing here? And I'm in the untenable position of trying to convince a jury, without court instruction, that Donald Trump, who completely talks about change, 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 unrelated to anything, as though he was on a stage in a play, not in a courtroom.
Okay. I think we have your point.
Thank you.
I will give you just a bit for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Novak.
Thank you for my watch. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The issue of this unfair practices claim is resolved by the fact that the judge, exercising her discretion, and the standard is abuse of discretion, elected not to instruct the jury on that claim because she found, based on the original complaint, based on all the proceedings that had happened between the complaint and the trial, all the way up to that, that the plaintiff had not alleged any unfair practice claim that wasn't dependent upon the deception claim. The deception claim was tried to the jury, and the plaintiff lost.
Mr. Colwin's closing point, which is that I thought he made a good argument that if from the outset Trump had intended to lure people in with his promise of the wonderful amenities and the cost sharing and so on, and all along he intended to pull the rug out from under them. So they were not just taking a risk, it was a certainty that they were going to lose all their amenities. Wouldn't that be a basis for a fraud claim?
It not only could be, the judge allowed that to go to the jury. That's the very claim.
He said she wouldn't instruct them that the change clause was not a complete defense.
Well, that's a slightly different issue, Judge.
But it's an important issue, because if there is a way in which there could be a fraud-based recovery, even with the change clause in the contract, the jury, it's not the most obvious of propositions. The jury needs instruction on that.
The jury was instructed clearly and according to the law. We use the standard instruction on consumer fraud. But, it said exactly what the elements were.
But how specifically did it relate to the change clause? You were up there over and over again saying there's a change clause, ergo no problem if it's changed.
That's not what I said. I said there's a change clause, therefore, in order for the plaintiff to win, the plaintiff needs to prove both a change and something more. And the something more was instructed, was in the instructions, which was exactly what Judge Posner is saying. If there was no intent from the get-go to ever leave those amenities in, that would be the something more. I said that in my closing argument as clear could be. I said the plaintiff could win if they prove change plus, and then I argued why there wasn't the plus, and the jury accepted that argument and found that there was no fraud. The only instruction that counsel offered to the court on the change clause as not a defense was completely overbroad, and that was the only one he submitted. He said in his proposed instruction that the change clause couldn't be used as any part of our defense. Everybody agrees, even the plaintiff never argued to the contrary, that the change clause went to reliance, it went to causation, it went to punitive damages, it went to a number of those defenses. Look at the instruction that he proposed. It was completely one-sided, argumentative, and unfair, and she appropriately rejected it.
Well, but the question is, did it get through to the jury well enough? Because the unfairness idea under the Act overlaps a bit with the deceptive practices. Illinois seems to follow the FTC against Sperry and Hutchinson approach. Is a practice immoral, unethical, oppressive, or unscrupulous? Well, those are words that you might use to describe somebody who in the back of his mind thinks, aha, I'll get people in here to put $500,000 down on condo units. I'll keep the $500,000 and pull the rug out from under them on these nice commercial amenities that they were counting on. That doesn't sound scrupulous to me.
Well, Judge, she went to the jury on the claim you're just saying, which is I never intended and I pulled out the rug. The other claim that's available, but wasn't exercised in this case, is where you have no deception, but you have the kind of unfairness that Your Honor is talking about. That's the instruction he asked for. That's the instruction that wasn't given because, exercising her discretion, she said that isn't the way this case was ever presented from the get-go.
It's not
the other day in my letter.
There's an objective part of this, and then there's discretion. Objectively, we would need to look at the trial to see if it was presented. She made an assessment of the evidence, and of course the way the entire case had developed, she did so at great length after all these opinions we read through. And she decided it hadn't been presented. Once it's been presented, she certainly has discretion to craft an instruction that will accurately reflect what's there.
Well, the instruction was rejected before the trial, and it was based on 3 years of experience that judge had, not only with the pleadings, but within all the briefing on the arguments, all the oral hearings that we had before her. It starts from the complaint. And in my letter...
What are we to make of the district judge's decision not to dismiss at the motion to dismiss level or at the summary judgment level the unfairness claim?
Because in those motions and those briefings, she was assuming, rightly, that the unfairness claim was based on deception. And she said they alleged enough to prove deception if they could prove it in front of the jury. So, of course, she denied the motion to dismiss. She thought she was denying a motion to dismiss on a deception fraud, unfair practices claim, because that's what was pleaded. Paragraph 80.
So are you arguing, actually, that it's just that the plaintiffs didn't tease out for the district judge we have two separate theories here. One of them is an unfairness theory. One of them is a deception theory. And I mean, if that's the case, that's something I can at least understand. We'd have to look and see what we thought.
I actually have two arguments, and the first one is exactly that. They didn't make that claim. Read my letter from the other day where I reprinted exactly what paragraph 85 said. It said that all of the deceptive, fraudulent, all those words supports both the unfairness and the deception. It's the same thing. But number two, let's assume for a minute that she should have given that instruction. The failure to do so was harmless. Here's why it's harmless. There couldn't be if the unfairness that is argued is the change, say without deception, that's exactly what the contract said. We can make the change. And actually, Judge Posner, it's better than what you said. She not only could have gone to a lawyer, she went to a lawyer. That lawyer asked for that clause to be removed. They were told no. She told her broker, I'm very unhappy about that because they could make changes. But you know what? I'm going to go forward anyway. And if she had not gone forward, she had a 10-day attorney approval to not go forward, she would have gotten back every penny that she deposited. That's all she had to do. So not having done that, and because the contract said that it could be changed, it can't be unfair to do what the contract says.
Well, but there is in Illinois an overarching duty of good faith and fair dealing in contracts. We have to interpret clauses like the change clause in the light of that duty. And in part, that duty means that you can't actually just destroy the contract in the name of doing something that maybe technically falls within its language.
And I agree 1,000% with what you just said. But if the covenant of good faith and fair dealing applied, that creates a breach of contract action, which they also took to the court and lost. But it doesn't amount to a consumer fraud claim because the law in Illinois is as clear as law can be that you can't bring a breach of contract, you can't convert a breach of contract case to consumer fraud, even if what you're saying is, yeah, but it was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
But the concepts get very close. You know, if you think of Venn diagrams, yes, there's a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing over on the contract side, which is sort of a meta-contract theory, since that clause is just assumed to be present in every contract. And there is of this language, again, from Sperry and Hutchinson, immoral, unethical, oppressive, unscrupulous, et cetera. That all sounds a lot like breach of covenant of fair dealing.
Right.
So they're close in concept to each other.
But I agree that they're close, and that's why Martinez, the Illinois Appellate Court case that we cited, in a case just like this, where the seller said I could change the price under certain, where the seller had the right, if he couldn't deliver title, to walk away from the deal.
So
he had an absolute right to walk away. Oh, I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, go finish your thought, and then I want you to talk.
The seller had the right to walk away from the deal for that reason. Instead, he went and he tried to raise the price.
Right.
And the plaintiff sued both under breach of contract, breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and consumer fraud. The trier of fact in that case found that there was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that what he did unscrupulously, if you will, was took advantage of a title defect to try to get more money. So that part of the case, that decision was affirmed. The other thing that was affirmed by the appellate court was the refusal of the trial court to allow for a consumer fraud claim because the court said, but that's just the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. You've got your remedy. That the rubric that the Illinois courts want parties who are parties to contracts to use is breach of contract jurisprudence. The theory is you don't want to convert every common law fraud claim into a consumer fraud, and you don't want to convert every breach of contract claim into a consumer fraud. So Martinez said, even in a case where it found the seller was wrong and did breach that duty, it said, but you can't recover under consumer fraud.
Let me finish this.
Okay.
What you're suggesting, I think, is that if what the plaintiffs are really arguing is deception, it would be misleading. I think it would be burdensome on the defendants to have that charged both as fraud and as unfair. That's what you're saying. So the question is, so the closest analogy to what they're charging is bait and switch. So is bait and switch, when it's attacked, say, by the Federal Trade Commission, is that unfair? Is that, the relevant phrase, unfair deceptive acts or practices, is that unfair or is that deceptive?
Well, under Illinois' definition, and we are dealing with Illinois law, bait and switch means where a seller offers to sell something with no intention of ever selling it. That's deception. That's exactly what this case is.
So you're saying bait and switch is deception, and what they're doing, what they're charged with here is deception. Therefore, you want to segment the deception from the unfair. Is that it? You want to separate them. So you don't want the same conduct chargeable under both. If it's deceptive, it's charged as fraud or breach of contract or something.
Or consumer
fraud,
or even
consumer. If it's unscrupulous, something like that, then it's under the unfair practices.
Well, actually, the Consumer Fraud Act allows for both. You could allege a deceptive practice that is unfair because it was deceptive. You could allege some other practice that doesn't have deception. Here, the only allegation was this deception.
Now, that's my question. If the practice is deceptive, are you limited to challenging it under whether contract law or consumer fraud law that punishes fraudulent activity, or can you waive that or add to it an unfair practices act claim?
For the unfair practices,
you charge the same conduct under both.
If it's the same conduct under both, they've lost because that same conduct went to the jury, and the jury ruled that there wasn't that deceptive bait and switch where they intended never to convey
okay, so
the
amenities. You're saying the jury's factual finding would extinguish the unfairness claim.
It extinguishes the deceptive part of the unfairness claim, and what distinguishes the non-deceptive part are two things. One, it was never pleaded, and the judge properly exercised discretion not giving the jury an instruction on something that's never pleaded, never developed in the case. And secondly, even assuming that was an error, it's harmless because either there was deception or not. If there was deception, they already had that case and lost. If it was not deception, then all they were doing was doing what the contract said they could do. How can it be unfair to do what the contract allows you to do unless you violate the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, in which case you're on breach of contract and not consumer fraud? So I think any which way you look at this, they lose their unfair practices.
Okay, so now I want to take you to a different aspect of the case that we haven't discussed yet. And that's the question whether there's a private right of action under the Illinois Condominium Act for the failure to seek that 75% buyer approval for changes. I was not overwhelmed by the reasoning that there's a distinction between the private right of action on the disclosure claim and a private right of action under the 75% approval. And in fact, they really all seem to be things that the statute taken as a whole is getting at to make sure that exactly situations like this don't come up. If there's a material change, this looks to me like one of these general public laws that is not subject to modification by parties that's designed to protect purchasers. So how can we allow this change to go forward without the seller's notification or obtaining of the approval of the changes in the condo documents?
Well, first of all, there's no contractual obligation to give notice or approval, even though counsel said that.
I understand that. I'm saying it's a just like franchise protection laws, there are a set of laws that parties are not entitled to override by contract.
Addressing the statutory argument then, Your Honor, you're right. There's two different requirements within the same Section 22.
Right.
One's that disclosure requirement. One's the no amendment without approval. In the no disclosure part of it, I should say the legislature expressly gave a private right of action for violation of the disclosure aspect of Section 22. It did not give an express private right of action with respect to the amendment.
Is there some public remedy?
There could possibly be, and I'm not here to argue for the plaintiff.
Well, I mean,
it
would be odd to require something in the Condominium Act, and then say, well, we require it, but if you flout our requirement, nothing happens to you.
Well, I believe there is a public remedy. The Attorney General could take action to enforce.
What do you mean take
requested?
Action? Condominium Act have a provision for enforcement?
Can you cite us to a section? I couldn't find that, and that was one of the reasons I thought you could certainly read the disclosure part as the legislature specifying that only the remedy of rescission is available, but frankly, seeking 75% approval is another form of protection for the buyers, and I don't know why the inference has to be drawn that there's absolutely no remedy, and especially if you can't point to some section in the mm-hmm. statute that says, you know, anytime anything else is violated, the Attorney General can sue or whatever.
Well, Judge, I apologize that I don't have that citation. I'm confident that there is such a thing, but I would have to submit it after this. But
you said in your brief, which puzzled me, you said that actually there's no evidence in the record as to whether there was a vote.
As to whether there was what?
There was a vote.
There's no evidence in the record whether there was a vote. I took that to mean that there was no vote. They just did this, and they didn't go through the 75% approval process. Had they done so, I am firmly of the personal view that we would not be here having the same argument, because I don't know what 75% of the owners would have done, but it would have been a much better case.
Right, but the reason, Judge, that
well, what does
it doesn't
the
matter
what
here.
Does the record show?
Pardon?
The way you put it in your brief, it sounded as if there was simply no record evidence on whether there had been a
well,
vote, which is not the same thing as saying there wasn't a vote.
That's right. The record is silent on that. That was just something that neither the plaintiff nor the defendant
put in.
So I
thought that
certainly
the
plaintiff's
burden. The
district judge
just shut it off so early, saying there's no private right of action. And I'm concerned about that. Illinois does, under some circumstances, recognize implied private rights of action. This looks to me like actually a rather strong case for an implied private right of action, if you think what
could
private attorneys general do.
I'd like to address that, if I may. Illinois has another strong principle, repeated in the Metzger case in 2004, the DW case in 2005. And the Metzger case is the case that has those four elements. But both of those cases say there's one situation that trumps it all. Forget about the four factors. Forget about balancing. If the legislature in the same statute granted an express private right of action in one section but didn't in another section, the court is not to imply that the legislature intended to imply.
Now, that would be fine
if
there were a public remedy. And maybe there is, or maybe it's implicit. It just seems odd that they would insert a requirement and yet there be absolutely no remedy.
Well, I'll answer two things. If I could
say
two things. May I say two things about
that?
Well,
let me just say, again, you know, this language, the part that you're relying on under Metzger for the private right of action, is really, as I see it, a confining. It's rescind. It gives a time, any time before the closing. It gives the right to interest at a certain rate. It specifies these things. This is all in 605/22. And so it's just not clear. If there's a change, then that's another example of a different kind of problem. You know, suddenly whether it should be conceptualized as a breach of contract, if you make that change without getting the 75% approval or a statutory violation, Because otherwise you have an unredressed statutory violation.
You don't.
Why would anybody ever bother to ask the owners for their approval?
You don't have that, Judge, because you could bring that claim under other principles. You could bring it under, just like they did here. You could say that, oh, but you didn't do that, and that's unscrupulous, and that's a violation.
I don't see where you get a claim that the change is ineffective because 75% of the owners didn't vote for it, unless it's under the Condo Act. And under your view, no condominium owner in their right mind would ever ask the unit owners to approve anything because it's a meaningless... And of course, Illinois also has the provision that you don't construe statutory provisions to be meaningless.
Well, there's a difference in when you say every. We had a provision that the plaintiff agreed to that we could make changes.
And that's
in most cases, you don't have that.
I understand, but there are some laws, like the Uniform Commercial Code, for the most part, just sets out default rules, and it's very clear that the parties can modify those if they want to, particularly between merchants. There are other laws, like franchise protection statutes, that cannot be changed by private contractual action because the whole reason they're there is to protect a party in a lesser bargaining power position. And I asked at the outset, what kind of law do you think the Condo Act is? Is that default rules or is that a mandatory public policy rule?
Well, I would say that's...
You seem to think it can be varied, but I have a hard time putting it in that box, actually.
But a plaintiff in this situation, the Consumer Fraud Act, the one that they tried for a different issue in this case, not for the 75%, never an allegation that 75% violated consumer fraud.
Yeah.
But the Consumer Fraud Act says that it captures the violation of any other statute. Any other statute that is made for the public good, if that's what the court interprets this Condo Act to be, could form the part of a consumer fraud claim.
So maybe the district court made an error as a matter of law in not realizing that there is, in fact, a private right of action for the 75% rule, which arises under the Consumer Fraud Act.
Well, a court can't sit there and litigate a case for the parties. The parties, after all, set their own case. There was never a suggestion at any time in this case that the 75% rule violated the Consumer Fraud Act. And all I'm saying is that I'm not conceding that it could, but that was an avenue that could avoid the thought that there's no remedy. And the final point I'm going to make to this court, because I know this court respects legislatures, and particularly when we're talking about interpreting Illinois law, being bound by Illinois law, if there's a gap in a statute, it is not for a court to fill that gap in. It is for the legislature.
No, that's not right.
Well, I submit that it is. If the legislature didn't, if there's a mistake here, that there should have been a remedy. We cite you three cases, including two federal courts.
It's very unfair to the legislatures. For courts never to be willing to correct an obvious mistake, right?
Well, I would agree with
that. Scrivener's errors?
But this is not a
scrivener's error. You're not going to say courts can't ignore those.
I wouldn't say that, but this is not a scrivener's
error. So you overstated your position.
We had three cases that we cited that said that the remedies in 22 are not expandable. All three courts said that. And so I would submit that we should not expand the remedies that are there. There is a remedy for the non-disclosure. And the two coalesce. Don't they coalesce here? Because we do have a plaintiff who had every opportunity to back out of this deal knowing that this change might be made and didn't do so. We can't decide this case purely on theory. We do have a real case here with a real plaintiff.
Yes, but notice how you're just turning your position 180 degrees. First, 2 minutes ago, you were saying, oh, whatever the legislature says, we're bound and so on. Now you're saying, well, let's look at it realistically, the situation of this plaintiff and so on and so forth.
I'm just saying that this isn't the case in which to make that expansion. If the court believes it's its duty to expand the remedies of the Illinois legislature, this isn't the case to do it because she got a fair trial on just the issue of these changes. These changes were tried, and she lost. Thank you very much for the time.
All right, thank you very much. I'll give you 2 minutes, Mr. Cullen.
Thank you. Just a couple of brief points. I want to clarify one thing, particularly because of Judge Flom's question. We had a deceptive practices claim that said they knew and they did it anyways. Okay? During this trial, Mr. Novak argued repeatedly, and this is a direct quote from his closing argument, you can't have a right to change and a lawsuit about change. In opening statement, he said, Mrs. Goldberg conceded in an email that she knew because the change clause existed, she had no court case. We asked for a curative instruction there. At the close of evidence, we repeatedly asked for instructions. During the entire trial, Mr. Trump repeatedly said, no, change. This jury ultimately was left with the decision of, what does the change clause mean in this statutory fraud case? They did not get a complete statement of the law.
But is your idea to bait and switch is something different from a deceptive practice?
No, that's a deceptive practice, Judge.
Well, what's the unfair practice not a deceptive practice?
Second, apart from the unfair thing, so we wanted the instruction.
No, answer my question. What is the unfair practice that's separate from a deceptive practice?
The unfair practice that's separate from the deceptive practice is that even if they didn't know going in that they were going to take this away, to put something in and say, and this is what the testimony was, undisputed. They put it in there because there were certain buyers they knew wouldn't buy without this, including Mrs. Goldberg. And then down the road, no change circumstances occur, solely for their own financial benefit. They take it away, which is fine.
But if they warn you, I mean, that's like saying selling a person a risky investment or something like that. If you disclose the risk, What is unfair?
And here, just because my time is limited, Your Honor, they don't disclose the risk because it's
no,
both
they disclose the risk in the sense that they're saying we can rescind these favorable provisions.
It's solely
if they say that, and you accept it, taking a chance, and you're a mature person, and you're informed, and you have legal advice, and so on, then what's unfair?
What's unfair, Judge, is that it's totally contrary to custom and industry and the practice, so she wouldn't be informed. She'd never expect it to happen.
There's nothing wrong with going against custom.
And the statute.
If you warn a person. Right?
Perhaps not, but to then say to you, okay, but you don't get your money back, I think it's unfair.
But that's clear from the contract, you don't get your money back.
Not if they make changes without her approval. On another point, Your Honor, there was a statement that, what was the vote? What was the evidence? We specifically pled in our first complaint that there was not 75% approval. We pled it.
Was there a vote?
To our knowledge, there was, but we pled that. We intended to prove it.
Wait, I'm lost. You think there was a vote? You don't know the outcome?
Because we never got the discovery on it because she dismissed the private right of action, so there was nowhere to go with that. We never got any farther. Once she dismissed the private right of action, what was the point of doing discovery on it? We were done. It was over. And we pled it. So that's number two. And I just wanted to point that out. The other point I just wanted to make.
I don't understand. You couldn't have said to her, well, we'd like to nail down the 75% because, you know, it would be important for an appeal.
It's been my experience, Judge, when they dismiss your claim and you try to start doing discovery on something that's outside your claim, you usually get shut down.
Don't you want to ask the judge?
Sometimes. I guess it depends which judge it is, to be perfectly honest with you. So here's the crux of it as well. Look, these statutory fraud claims went to a jury on a statutory fraud. Put aside everything else. Throw it all out. On a statutory fraud claim of deceptive practices, the entire trial ended up revolving around whether or not the change clause barred those claims. The court refused to instruct. The jury was left to decide, does the clause bar it or doesn't it? We submit, given the evidence in this case, which we thought was pretty compelling, that Mr. Trump knew what he was doing.
But what could you have added on the unfairness issue by way of evidence? I understand you were denied the instruction at the end, Mr. Colby, and I'm accepting that you well pled the unfairness. What more... Why wasn't that the emphasis?
I'm being unclear, Judge. I'm being unclear. What I'm saying is the part that went to the jury was deceptive practices. And what I'm saying is She should have instructed that the claim is not barred by the clause, and she didn't, so we didn't get a fair trial. Secondarily, what could we have added if she had let the unfair practices claim, which she took away before the trial, right before the trial, even after saying, by the way, in the motion to dismiss, contrary to what you just heard, in the motion to dismiss, she said, it doesn't matter if they haven't pled deception well enough, and they have. They've got a separate claim unrelated to deception, unfair practices. What we could have added was our expert testimony, which was undisputed and unchallenged, in which he went through a series of factors, factual factors, that we could have argued to the jury, if you compare those factors to the Robinson standards, it's unfair. And we laid it all out in our brief, Judge. That's what we could have done. What I want to be crystal clear for you, Your Honor, is there's two things. One is we're saying she took away the unfair practice claim, which was properly pled. If we pled it poorly, tell us at the motion to dismiss stage and we'll amend. She took it away after denying summary judgment on it, okay, and barred a claim that was viable, that she said was viable, that she said we could prevail upon. Unrelated to that, we had a deceptive practice phase, a bait and switch, if you will.
But she takes it away at the end of the trial.
No, before the trial, Judge. Well, she took the unfair practices claim away after the motion to dismiss, after summary judgment. We submitted an instruction for the unfair practices claim.
You submitted the instruction prior to trial?
Prior to the trial, right before the trial. And she said, I'm not giving this instruction. You haven't properly pled the claim. They're surprised. They didn't allege surprise. They don't allege surprise here. They just say we didn't plead it right. If we didn't plead it right, tell us at 12B time. We'll amend. But she did it literally days before the trial with no basis of it. And we had expert testimony that would have substantiated it. And so that's one issue. The second issue, though, is on the claim that did go to the trial, did go to the jurors. They talked about, as you just heard, the change clause bars
the
claim.
I think we've covered this.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you.